Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Dick Grantham of Arroyo Grande, California, where he's going to celebrate his 93rd birthday on July 11th. We heard about some of his unique adventures as a teenager, hitchhiking, riding the rails, driving a tilt-a-whirl truck with the carnival, operating dangerous logging equipment, even riding a draft horse 35 miles an hour bareback, all before he enlisted in the Navy at age 17 in 1943. And what was it about the Navy that attracted you? Because I'm sure you could have waited a little longer, been drafted into the Army. You could have tried to get into the Marine Corps or maybe something in the air. What was it about the Navy that you liked?
Well, I don't know. The sea. I think it was the sea. I was interested in the sea. I do remember one thing in boot camp in San Diego. First couple of nights, I see some of the guys in their bunks where they were crying. You know, and I thought, I guess, wonder what they're crying about, and realized that, well, they must really had some home. With me, it was different. Entirely different. When I got in the Navy in the boot camp, had a place to sleep, they supplied me with clothing and food. I was all taken care of, you know, for the first time. And so just another job to me.
A lot better than having to rely on the sheriff letting you sleep in the jail in Colorado, huh?
Yeah, right. I guess so.
Or riding the rails. I mean, it's a different world, and so many of us can't identify with that. And you're giving us a taste of what it might have been like. So you're in the Navy. You want to be a quartermaster. Were there some challenges along that path? Were there some things that were difficult maybe to grasp or master or deal with?
Well, the only thing about quartermaster school is the school itself. We had to learn celestial navigation. We had to learn the rules of the road, the names of all of the flags. We had to learn semaphore and Morse code. So I was able to go through all of that and with the cloud conditions. There's a name for each type of cloud. I used to know the names of all the different, and the sea conditions and white caps and stuff. The quartermaster's job in the Navy, one main thing on his watch on the bridge, he had to log every little incident that happens in the quartermaster's log. So at the end of the watch, the officer of the deck would take the quartermaster's log and make a Reader's Digest version of it to go in the ship's log. So everything in the ship's log as always comes from the quartermaster.
A lot of responsibility for a kid who quit school at 15. Did you have a preference as to what kind of ship you ended up on? Did you have an idea in your head that I want to be on such and such a ship?
No. Oh, incidentally, when we left San Diego the first time and sailed down south down there, we crossed the equator, and we had a big initiation crossing the equator. They had a big throne in front of the bridge there for King Neptune to sit on, and we had a horrible, that's what they did to us. So when you start out, you're a polywog, and when you finish with all your initiations, you're a trusty shellback. So now I'm a trusty shellback. But anyway, the thing that was a horrible thing that we had to go through. Anyway, what I do remember is this is right in the middle of World War II. We lowered the ensign and two-blocked the Jolly Roger. And the Jolly Roger is a skull and crossbones black flag. And all day long, right in the middle of World War II, the Jolly Roger was two-blocked. And that for the whole thing. And I often wondered, later on, I've wondered what would have happened if some Japanese submarine had come by and seen that Jolly Roger. But anyway, that never happened. But that was quite an experience. And then I was in Espirito Santo for 2 weeks, and Hollywood stars come by to entertain us. One of them was Bob Hope came to visit. And so I remember Bob Hope coming to entertain us there. Then I got assigned to a ship. I didn't know what ship I was going on or anything until I got there. And it was the USS DuPage, APA, 41, which was a cargo ship with two holds forward and one hold aft, 5-inch cannon on the fantail and a 5-inch cannon on the forecastle, loaded with guns. When I got aboard, I thought, I'm not even assigned to the ship. I'm assigned to the Commodore. When a Commodore was ahead of the whole landing fleet, and I was in his staff as a quartermaster. So I spent a lot of time in the chart room and, of course, duties on the bridge. So that was it.
I want to hear about your first taste of combat and all of that, but to help us understand what was expected of you, what was a typical day like for you? What were the duties that you had to carry out?
Well, I had to go and watch. Watch was a four-hour watch. But be on the bridge to log everything, the quartermaster's log, everything that happened during the whole watch.
Was it the same stuff over and over again, or was there always something that would break that monotony up?
Well, it was probably a lot of monotony, but a lot of things are the same, but it was always interesting being on the bridge, and I enjoyed every part of that. I liked it. I had a good time. I think I picked the right rate. It was a rate that I seemed to be good at, and I loved celestial navigation anyway, but the chart room, that was boring when I'd get in there. I'd have to make corrections on the chart. The thing that would happen was the Japanese had taken all these little islands over, so they wouldn't let us near them, you know. I always had the feeling that was Amelia Earhart flying over to learn more about these things. But anyway, when we finally taken these islands over, we had chart corrections and it put on the chart. That was kind of boring, but there was a lot of it and a lot of work to do, and that was about it.
This may seem a little silly, but I'm just thinking about all the people listening. And, you know, we have people anyway from your age down to not even teenagers yet listening right now. They live in a world where you have GPS on something you hold in your hand, and that tells you instantly where you are on the globe. You guys didn't have that, and you talked about celestial navigation. So for someone who's never done that, doesn't understand it, how do you explain what that is and how it works, how you figure out where in the world you are?
One main tool was a sextant. We had to know the stars, names of the different stars. And now the difference between a star and a planet, a star twinkles, a planet doesn't. But anyway, we had to learn all about where the different stars, there were star charts that we'd go by, and we'd look at a certain star with a sextant. We'd get that star right in our sextant and bring that star right down to the horizon with a sextant and take a bearing on it. And then also the time, the instant that we took that bearing on our stopwatch, we'd find out the time. And then we'd look at another star in a different direction, and we'd take a sight on it, and then with a sextant we'd bring it down to the horizon and take a bearing on it and the time again. And where the two lines would cross is where we were at the sea. And if it was a cloudy condition and there were no stars, then we'd go by what they'd call dead reckoning.
And you said you also had to learn semaphore, what the flags mean, Morse code, blinking lights from other ships and from your ship that would communicate. And you talked about your APA. You said it's a cargo ship with two holds forward and one aft, but the cargo was people, invasion troops, right? I mean, that was the purpose of your ship, to take invasion troops to these islands in the Pacific.
2,000. Each ship had 2,000, and the Commodore, he was ahead of the whole landing fleet. Now, I don't know how many ships were in that, but they're all kinds of landing craft.
So what was the first invasion that you were a part of on that APA?
The first invasion I was in is called Peleliu. Peleliu is an island in the Pacific in the Palau. Peleliu was the main one, and in that we took our 2,000 troops and we landed them there. The thing is, I got to know some of them. I have great respect for Marines because the Marines, to me, are the heroes of World War II. This one Marine, it was his first invasion, and it was my first invasion. And so we'd sit on the deck of the ship, and we'd talk about different stuff. He told me that he could hardly wait to get ashore and start killing. And I thought, well, he must have learned something different in his boot camp than I did, because it wasn't considered killing. But apparently, when you're in a Marine, that's the thing you teach you, is to kill. And he was really gung-ho. He was ready to go ashore. So anyway, we did have the landing at Peleliu, and he went ashore with the rest of them. And two or three days later, he came back to the ship. He was slightly wounded. And so we were talking to him then about it. I says, how's it there? And he says, Dick, he says, I don't want to go back. I just want to go home. I don't want to kill anybody out. I just want to go home. But he says, I know I'm going to have to go back again because I'm slightly wounded. And they fixed me up, and I know I'm going to have to go back. And, of course, he did go back, and I never heard from him. But I do know the second day of the operation, the whole Peleliu looked like a great big gray cloud. I saw the one airplane go by and crash into that gray cloud. Our guns were going off for a whole month, 24/7. All of our guns on our ship, and I remember the shells just covered the deck, empty shells, after the 5-inch shot them, you know. And then we had a battleship, and next to us it was going off all the time. And the second day of the operation, the Wind Talkers, they had their radio was damaged beyond repair. And so they needed, asked for a volunteer to take some radio gear ashore. So here I am, 17 years old, not fully developed in the brain yet. And I thought, yeah, I want to go ashore. I want to see what it's like ashore, you know. And so I did that second day. I went ashore. And I guess about 50 yards from the shore, I thought, Dickie, what the heck did you get yourself into? I thought, you idiot, you know. And so as we went ashore, one landing craft on one side of me was blown up, and all I could see is dead bodies floating all around, you know. And so anyway, I learned one thing on this occasion, that under no circumstances ever do you ever volunteer for anything. And I remember years later when I moved to Royal Grandy, one neighbor was a colonel in the Marine Corps. He says, Dick, you volunteered to go ashore at Peleliu? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, you know, you're a damn fool. And I figured that out right away, you know. And he says, you know how we volunteered in the Marine Corps? You, and you. And so the Marines are my heroes to me. They're the real heroes. That was Peleliu. We finally, after 30 days, the Army come and took over because there's no Marines left. They're all gone.
Yeah, the Marines took heavy, heavy losses at Peleliu. But I want to hear about what else you experienced. So you volunteered to go ashore, and you said you were taking radio equipment. This is to the Navajo code talkers, yes, who had their unbreakable code?
Yes, that was the Navajos, yeah.
So you met up with them and handed this over?
I just handed it to a submarine that was there. That's all I know. That's all I did. So I'm not one of the heroes. I was kind of a passenger on during the war. But the real heroes are the ones that are still there, that died there. And they're my heroes.
One you talked about, and it was very powerful hearing the before and after for that Marine, before and after combat there at Peleliu. Were there people there, or maybe even later on, that you got to know very well, that you count among those heroes, the ones who never came home?
No, I really didn't get to know any of them, except this one fellow that I did get to know pretty well. And I don't know whatever happened to him. But I do remember on the officer's wardroom where they converted into an operating room, and I'd have to go by there all the time, and I'd see these doctors operating around the clock. How they did that was, and I watched some of the Marines there being operated look pretty bad because I could see them as I walked by, you know. And it was, I feel, well, those guys they're the heroes.
So you were there for a month, and that had to be exhausting. You saw things you'd never seen before. Do you remember what it was like after that? Was there concern, fear, anticipation that you're going to see more of the same as you moved on to the next battle?
I don't remember anything about fear, but what I do remember is that after that, we sailed around different places for a little bit, and that was when we went to our next invasion.
And that next invasion would be in late October 1944, when General Douglas MacArthur had his famous return to the Philippines at Leyte. Dick Grantham and the USS DuPage also landed troops in Lingayen Gulf in January 1945, and he would participate in the invasion of Okinawa in April aboard another APA, the USS Elmore. But in between came a day that almost ended his life, a day that saw 35 of his shipmates killed, four times that many wounded. The Purple Heart on his wall is a lasting reminder, and we're going to hear some of the story behind it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.